Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Alexi Sale podcast, starring me, Alexi Sale. Actually, big news in my life this week is I got a new shed. I just heard the rain falling on the roof of it. And it's horrible. My friend Roland socially distancedly put it up for me. It's an enormous... I used to have a wooden shed and it's sort of rotted and fell down. And so I've got this sort of big metal one. And it's a confined space. So Roland had like a very traumatic 3 days putting it up. But it's up now. It's big. I've got both my bikes in it and all my gardening stuff. So years ago, when we had a different flat, I bought a shed. I like a shed. I very much like a shed. I bought a shed and it came from a place called Half Price Sheds of Ealing. But I thought, how do they know they're half price, the sheds? But then I learned that this is when we were in the EC, there's a European Commission that sets the European shed standard price. So it's published every day, the European shed standard in euros and also in pounds. And then the sheds at Half Price Sheds of Ealing are exactly half that price. So that's something else that we've lost out by leaving the EC. We you know, it's fucking chaos out there now. We don't know whether our sheds are half price or what. This is podcasting for you. So anyway, we'll be doing the emails at the end, basically. But first of all, somebody emailed into my website, which is a bit neglected, really, because I'm putting all my efforts into this, but I should maybe write some stuff. But somebody asked me a question on my website, and they were asking me about the opening song of Series 2 of Alexi Sale's stuff. Now, Series 2 of stuff, we did a different opening song for each of the series. The Series 2 starts with this idea that I'm actually a cartoon character, a Disney cartoon character. And it's 50 years since I starred in my first film, which was called Steamboat Fatty. And this cartoon character of Alexi Sale, we're celebrating 50 years, and you see me being animated and stuff. And then the show starts with this song, which is a parody of the Disney Club song, which is how it goes, A-L-E-X-E-I-S-A-Y-L-E. Who's an ugly... How does it go? A-L-E-X-E-I-S-A-Y-L-E. Alexi Sale, Alexi Sale. And then these little kids come on. Alexi Sale, Alexi Sale. We love to hear him swear on the TV. He, he, he. Everybody give 3 cheers except the BBC. A-L-E-X-E-Y-A-S-A-Y-L-E. Who's an ugly bastard and as fat as he can be? A-L-E-X-E-I-S-A-Y-L-E. Alexi Sale, Alexi Sale, Alexi Sale, Alexi Sale. Everybody gives 3 cheers except the BBC. And then this very sweet little kid goes, who's that fat bastard? And there is a rumour on the internet, I think, that little girl is not Ashley Cole. That would be Cheryl Cole. Because she's got Cheryl written on her jumper. But I don't think it is Cheryl Cole, whatever she's called now. Do you know what she's called now, Talal? Cheryl, she was called like Cheryl Mussolini.
Cheryl Tweedy was her old name.
Was it? And she was called like something Italian, Cheryl Mussolini. Antipelli vasculitis.
Cheryl Ann Tweedy.
Cheryl Ann Tweedy.
Fernandez Versini.
Fernandez Versini. You see, I knew she had a different name now. Anyway, I don't think it's anyway, so what the person who emailed into my into my website was asking was whether we had any trouble with the Disney organization because we'd done a parody of the Disney Club song. And the answer is basically no. But in the Fair series of stuff, there's a sketch, which I think was my idea, but then David and Andrew worked on it. We did this sketch called, Snow White and the Seven Samurai, which ends with, I think, Snow White getting her head chopped off by a samurai, which you probably couldn't do these days. Anywho, after the show was transmitted, The Disney organisation issued a writ. So me and David Nandrew and Marcus Mortimer, the producer-director, we went to see the BBC barrister, who was, I think it was BBC, I think she was a barrister, a woman. And we were I was expecting it to be all legalese, you know, on the one hand this and on the other hand that, you know, ipso facto demis rusos under the meaning of the act and all that. But she had a look at the writ and she said, fuck Disney, we're the BBC. I thought, yeah, fucking brilliant, wow. And she said, we're the fucking BBC, man. Fuck Disney, they do this all the time. We're not going to, you know. You know, we're not going to respond to their threats, you know. And it went away. So I thought, well, that was amazing. That was a real example of the old BBC. I think probably now it's a much more kind of cowardly organisation. You wouldn't get that kind of bravado anymore. But maybe that's why the Disney organisation didn't object when we did that song. We didn't hear a dicky bird out of it.
Of course, Alexei Sayle wasn't always the sophisticated character we know today. 50 years ago, he was just a twinkle in the eye of his creator, the late Walt Disney. From the block of ice, where he's now frozen in a state of cryogenic submersion, Uncle Walt sent this message.
Happy birthday, Lex.
It certainly doesn't seem 50 years since we made history together when you starred in the first talking cartoon back in 1939.
News stories. Let's look at the news, shall we? Now, the news story that's caught my eye this week is the supposedly leaked report from some public relations specialists to the Labour Party, saying that if they wanted to win back voters, they should basically wrap themselves in the Union Jack, be much more upbeat about militarism, and generally be indistinguishable from the Tory party, really. And you can already see that Keir Starmer, the twat, has taken this on board. And you can see that he's, in all his pronouncements, he has a Union Jack behind him. And I think, you know, it's a very apposite strategy for Keir Starmer. I think it's because, like him, it's bogus. It's fake. It's never going to work. It's kind of out Ed Miliband-ing. Ed Miliband, really. It's a nonsense. You know, it's fake, really. I mean, you know, you can get that from the Tories. Why would you want that from the Labour Party? Nevertheless, I think that the news is out there now. The fact is out there now that in 2017... if Corbyn, and it was a damn close run thing, if Corbyn had been elected Prime Minister in 2017, I think most people now know that I would have been in his cabinet. Now, most people obviously think that my role would have been something to do with the arts, nighttime economy, czar, minister for the arts, that kind of thing. But no, in fact, if Jeremy Corbyn had been elected to power in 2017, I would have been the Minister for Defence. You're like, what? But yeah, think about it. Now, I'm one of the few people on the left, few of the people in Jeremy's circle who knows anything about militarism. In fact, I am an obsessive fan. I watch documentaries about, you know, World War II in colour, World War II with Muppets. I watch all those documentaries. The reason for that, I think, is that when I was a kid, my mum wouldn't allow me any toy guns. So All the other kids in the street were playing with toy plastic cap guns. I was forced to make my own gun out of a slice of Hovis. What I used to do was I used to chew like a kind of L-shaped gun shape out of a slice of Hovis, and I'd run around the street with the other kids going, kew, 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 kew. And I was fine as long as it didn't rain. And then I was fucked and my gun would go all manky. So anyway, this has left me, or it could be, I think this is the psychological explanation for why I am obsessed with military matters. Or it could be that I'm just a creepy nerd, one or the other. Who can say? So anyway, I'm one of the few people on the left who knows all about militarism, and I can field strip an AK. I can tell you the difference between a T-54 tank and a M-48 Patton, between an M1A1 Abrams and a T-90, you know, RPG-7. All those different letters, I can say them all. 5.56 millimeter, I can say them all. L-7. So that's me. I know about military matters. So it seemed germane, relevant, that I would be made Minister for Defence. I'll also tell you this story that I think formed my attitude to the British and notions of militarism. Years ago, I was in a production of The Tempest at the Old Vic, directed by Jonathan Miller. And people say, oh, you're in The Tempest, Caliban, Nenonce. I say, no, I was Trinculo, a drunken servant. Now, Jonathan Miller's idea for this production of The Tempest was that The Tempest, Shakespeare's last play, that he'd written it just after the writings of Montaigne and the ideas of the noble savage, the discoveries of the Americas, all that stuff had happened. And so his idea was that the island, all the islanders, and Ariel, Caliban, they were all black, and all the shipwrecked people, the Venetians, they were all white people. So there's a lot of black actors in minor roles and major roles, Cyril Unry, Rudolph Walker, people like that. So I got friendly with one of the black actors in a minor role, a guy called John Adewole, somebody who's sadly... And no longer with us. But he'd been born in a tiny village in West Africa, but had ended up as an actor in London. And one night we went for a drink and we were chatting afterwards. And John Adewole said to me, he said, you know, the thing I like about Britain is, and I thought he was going to say, you know, multiculturalism or spaghetti hoops or the music of a flock of seagulls. He said, the thing I like about Britain is it is so violent. It is so violent. He said, everywhere you look, people are fighting. He said, you British, you are warriors. You are warriors. And for some reason, that made an impression on me. I thought, well, yeah, maybe we are. And certainly there is that strain of warrior, I think, or thinking that you're a warrior in the British people. I mean, there's a certain type of British person who thinks that they fought and indeed died during the First World War. So maybe not them, but there is nevertheless, within the British working class, a kind of respect or perhaps a warrior ethos. And I think the left resiles from that. The left poo-poos that ethos at its peril, really. So I had this kind of idea that I would utilize this. Now, obviously, the left has, you know, tremendous problems with militarism, with the British military, you know, colonialism, Northern Ireland, Iraq, all that kind of thing. So what my offer would have been as Minister for Defence was that we would retain an army. Obviously, we would withdraw from all our colonial outposts. We would have this tight, professional army. Because the other thing about, and people say, oh, how you pay for it? How you pay for it? Me. One of the things about the British Army, as the British military, as it's set up at the moment, is that everything, every piece of kit that they are equipped with is expensive garbage. Like, we have these new two aircraft carriers, the Queen Elizabeth and the Prince of Wales, with no aircraft on them, because the plane that's supposed to equip them, the F-35B Lightning II, has great difficulty taking off, flying anywhere, and landing, which is, you know, pretty much... A requirement for an aircraft. It's an unbelievably expensive piece of junk. It was the plane, they call it the plane that broke the Pentagon. And these gigantic aircraft carriers are also a complete waste of money. They cost, I think, $7 billion. £7 billion these two aircraft carriers. I mean, £7 billion, that'd buy you nearly a third of a failed track and trace system, wouldn't it? So everything the British Army is equipped with is junk. One of the several reasons for that, partly it's the chiefs of the defence staff that they just want, you know, these things that are incredibly expensive, you know, look good, high status, but, you know, absolutely garbage. It's also because essentially there is one people making all this stuff. Like we have these new destroyers, I think Type 46 destroyers that don't work when it gets warm. Their engines just cut out, and because their engines cut out, all their systems cut out, so they're essentially defenseless. And the F-35 Lightning B. And the F-35 Lightning B, I mean, can do nothing. That a 40-pound drone from Argos can not do nothing. The F-35 Lightning B can not do nothing that a 40-pound drone from Argos can not do nothing. Nuts. Do nothing. So it's a complete waste. So what I would say was we have a small, professional fighting force, tremendous respect, maybe more democratic as well, a lot more powers to the sergeants and, you know, the lower ranks. Ask what kind of equipment they was. Equipped with high-value, off-the-shelf equipment, small coastal protection boats, excellent shoes, decent rifles, stuff like that. Small, professional fighting force. And if by any chance there was any comedian who might be getting above themselves, then maybe the Minister of Defence could send them round to fuck them up. I don't know. That's just an extra thing. But that would have been my proposal anyway as Minister for Defence. Sadly, it failed to come about. Alexis
Do you want some emails, Alexi?
Yeah, no, I was going to say, because we were talking about, I'd sent, you know, people should apply to be my friend, and we'd had a few emails, hadn't we, that you told me about. There was one guy who said he was very good at soothing the egos of kind of big-headed individuals, really, and that qualified him to be my friend, which I think is, yeah, that is a good qualification.
Okay, so yeah, Stephen Lewis, who's from northern Spain, so he has a Spanish duck, which you can speak Spanish to.
Claro.
And he's good at managing and massaging the inflated egos of celebrity. Yeah, so Stephen sent an application to be your friend after your call.
And there was another guy?
And the other guy was called K1, I believe.
And he's a robot?
Friendship application, K1. Iranian-British anarchist.
Yeah, we get it. Okay, so, there's several problems with this. Obviously, at the moment, we wouldn't be allowed to meet. But I had a thought a few years ago, before everything went digital, I found an old address book. And in it, there was all these people called, like, Xavier X-Ray, and these addresses written down, and, like, John Xanadu and stuff. I thought, what the hell is this? And then I remembered, a few years before, I'd had a column in the Sunday Mirror newspaper. And I really liked the readers. This was 1987. And they reckon then that the Sunday Mirror, they sold about 3 million copies, but it was read by 8 million people. But they were lovely. I really loved the people who, it seemed to me, the people who read the Sunday Mirror. They were kind of working class, but intelligent, you know, left wing, obviously. And just, they seemed like really sweet people. And I wrote a piece one day about my address book. It was an analogue thing then, you know, with a pen and paper and a little address book. And I'd been looking through my address book and I realised that I had every letter, and I even had two Zs. I had my friend Oscar Zarate and Benjamin Zephaniah. So I had two Zs. I had As, I had Bs, I had Cs, but I had no Xs. So I said, anybody who wrote in whose surname began with an X, I'd put them in my address book and then I'd send them a Christmas card. And I did. I actually did that. I remember I wrote all these, and like about seven people wrote in, and I think some of them, I think, you know, David X-Men from East Finchley might have been lying about his surname. But anyway, all these X-people, you know, and that's why, and I did, I sent them a Christmas card. And, I think I sent them a postcard from Me Holidays. Yeah, in the days when that happened. I'd promised them that the next time I went on Me Holidays, I'd send them a postcard. And I did, because I'm a man of my word. So at the moment, obviously, if you keep applying to be my friend, but we're not going to be able to meet. But I promise you that if you, I'll look at your applications and then I will send you. Maybe I'll send you one of those shitey electronic Christmas cards. I don't know, when people send me like an electronic Christmas card, I'm like, fuck you. Send me a fucking real card, you bastard.
We could do a video Christmas card for them. That's really
just
easy.
For them. Just for the friend applicants?
Yeah.
Yeah, or maybe, yeah.
We can, over or the we year, could do, yeah. You can pick five lucky winners who are going to get a personal...
Or I could they could have me, like, and we could pretend I'm on as, like, a Zoom call, and they're my, and I just do, like, a stock thing where I go, oh, I like your hat, something like that. And, we'll do something. So if you send me anybody who sends in a request to be my friend, I will do something... No, you're looking worried about
that's
that?
Okay.
Well, we'll see how many people do people. It, you know.
Well, we tried to do this segment a couple of weeks ago, and we cut it out of the podcast because it got a bit awkward. So let's be clear. What are the qualities you're looking for? So surnames beginning with X.
No, that's just an example. No, you misunderstood. Nothing to do with surname beginning.
Are you just going to accept anybody who sends in an email?
I don't know. We've only had two, haven't we, so far, applying to be my friend. So it's not like we're going to be inundated.
Okay.
All right. Well, we'll see. If this gets out of hand, then we'll
I've ruined two of your bits. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, thank you, Talat.
Please finish your... I agree with anything you say, Sarah Alexis.
All right, so this is what's going to... This is what I think will happen. So somebody sends in a request to be my friend. Then I will do something electronic... for them where it appears that I am their friend. Like send them a Christmas card or I'll do one end of a Zoom conversation that they can then use, you know, where I do like generic things. Like I said, like, how is your dog, cat, daughter, son, grandpa, father? Or I'll send them a Christmas...
Yeah, we've got 10 months to figure that out.
Christmas
yeah.
card or something, yeah.
Put friendship application in the subject header, and that way I can keep an eye on all of them.
All right. Let's let's do the emails now.
Okay. Good luck, everyone. Yeah, send those applications in.
If your name begins with X, as well, that's like a double.
Yeah, you're automatically. Okay. Great. Okay. So we've been. The only reason I panicked there is because we get a lot of emails, Alexi. That's all. So, like, now if everyone's going to send friendship applications to, they're more than welcome to, and I can't wait to read all of them. Okay, Christine, in a YouTube comment, actually, go to our YouTube page, Alexi Sale, to watch all of our bike rides there and to hear the podcast there as well. She really wants to know what your views are on the Navalny affair in Russia.
Yeah. No, thank you. Several things, really. First of all, Alexei Navalny is very much in the news at the moment. And firstly, as an entertainer, you train yourself to see references to yourself very quickly to scan newspapers or websites to see your name. And so I'm looking through all these websites. And I see Alexei. And I think, oh, I'm in The Independent, or I'm in The Economist, or I'm in Svenska Dagblad. And then I realise I've seen Alexei, it's Alexei fucking Navalny. It's not me. So, I'm suffering in this. Alexei Navalny thinks he's suffering, being poisoned and locked up. I'm the one who's really suffering. It's an interesting question, isn't it, Navalny? And thank you for asking me. First of all, I hold no brief for Putin. I think he's a thug. I think the people around him are thieves. So they have looted Russia, and they're anti-democratic. They often, I think, verge on the fascistic. So I hold no brief for Putin. But, you know, there's a kind of an aspect of the British media where the situation in Russia is complex. I think that the West has a great deal of blame. I think that we encouraged the oligarchs in the first place. We looked the other way, or we encouraged them to loot the assets of the Soviet Union rather than, you know, making any efforts to restrain them. NATO's belligerent moves towards the East, I think, are genuinely disconcerting for a country like Russia that has been constantly threatened from that direction. And the city of London is, you know, very much the place where the oligarchs launder their ill-gotten gains. So we have a part to play in the debacle that is modern Russia. There are also, you know, opponents of Putin from further left. There are opponents of Putin from the right. All these complexities are ignored. And what the Western political establishment and the media always do is they settle on one figurehead. Usually somebody who is photogenic and also somebody whose views align exactly with the interests of the West. And actually, and Navalny in many ways has not, as in the West, as in the past, had, I think, much more nationalistic inclinations. But now he's somebody that the West views as, you know, acceptable. And so they dub him the leader of the opposition and they focus all their attention on him. You know, they, I think, exaggerate probably the effect that he's having and stuff. And then after a while, he kind of, you know, he either gets somewhere or he goes away. And then the Western media loses interest. And I'm not saying clearly Navalny should be free to campaign. His supporters should be free to demonstrate and not be beaten up. But I have this kind of photogenic leader syndrome of the West, I find deeply suspicious. And sometimes it's even more malevolent. I don't know if you remember the fuss around Guaido in Venezuela, I think in 2019. Clearly, he was being groomed. And this is even in the liberal media like The Guardian. You know, Guaido, the leader of the opposition, they say that he's... I mean, really, I don't think anybody in Venezuela really knew who he was, but he was being groomed by the West to... take charge after there was a coup there. The coup failed. And so now you don't hear anything about him. And in fact, he's working in Aldi as a kind of filling bags. So, you know, the West loses interest. It's interesting, isn't it, their interest in... I mean, it's always... the leaders of the opposition are always seem to be as well somebody who... is leading a country that we're having a trade war with. So, you know, China, Venezuela, Russia, you know, there is a lot less noise around leaders of the opposition in countries where, you know, who are allies. There's also this interest in the human rights. I know this is Ian Duncan-Smith has developed a sudden and previously unheard of interest in human rights. And he is going on about the Chinese government's treatment of the Uyghur, the Muslim minority in China. Fucking Ian Duncan-Smith has never given a shit about anybody in the past. But suddenly, because we're having a fucking trade war with China, he's all like upset about the Uyghurs. Again, I hold no brief for the Chinese government. They are a brutish collection of bastards themselves. But, you know, I am deeply suspicious of Ian Duncan-Smith's sudden discovery of issues of human rights. There's also something slightly odd in Navalny's case. I have no doubt that Putin also murders his opponents abroad or at home. Litvinenko back in Russia and a Politkovskaya. He has no difficulty in eradicating his opponents. Quite what's going on with Novichok. Now, Novichok is supposed to be the deadliest nerve agent on the planet. The only person that Novichok has ever managed to kill is one woman in Salisbury, which sort of doesn't really make it seem that deadly, does it, really? And you know, when they talk about Novichok, we say weapons, it's a weapons grade nerve agent. I mean, what other kinds of nerve agents are there? I mean, kitchen grade, low calorie. So the story of the Novichok being planted in Navalny's underpants, I just think, I don't know about that one. Because if the Russians were, you know, maybe it's the Russians kind of like indulging in kind of surrealist comedy semi-murder that they don't, if they want to, if Putin wants you dead, you are dead. So these kind of botched attempts against the Skripals and Navalny, I find odd.
Okay, and now to our emails. If you've got a question for Alexei, send them to alexeysalepodcast@gmail.com. Keep them short and sweet. They'll be more likely to be read out on air. Richard, seeing as we're talking about Russia, Richard wants to know any book recommendations for an introduction to Maoist, Leninist, Marxist philosophy?
Well, book recommendations. Well, there's the Sacred Texts. If you know, the Communist Manifesto is probably the most accessible of the Sacred Texts of Marxism, written by Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. I'd start with that, really.
All right, start there, Richard. Let us know how you get on. Dave, he's a gardener in Scarborough. He wants to know how much prep goes into making these podcasts. What's your process? He wants any advice because he's going to start podcasting himself.
How much prep? Very little. I mean, for me, this is the podcast is a particular thing, really, that when I do my sandwich bar show, for instance, it is very, very tightly scripted, and everything has been worked out in front of an audience. Nearly everything has been worked out in front of an audience beforehand. It's tight, 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 full of every... I make sure my material is very dense, and I make sure that everything has been boiled down and boiled down to its essence, so it has got a fantastic hit rate. This, I mean, one of the reasons I'm doing this podcast is because I can't at the moment go out and trial material in comedy clubs or book readings, that I'm doing this instead. And so I deliberately, although I have some ideas in my head and I've got like a pad here with some notes on it, it's kind of deliberately rambling. It's very much against my instincts to do it this way, and I kind of force myself to do it because it's a way for me to do something different, something that's against my nature. And I always think, you know, it's useful to challenge yourself, but it's also a way for ideas to kind of bubble to the surface, I think. I do also think, though, Dave, I have been in the entertainment business for 42 years now, so I have accrued a certain amount of experience. And so, even though it's rambling, I do know, I think, what works to a degree. If you're doing a podcast, I would go the other way, not follow my method, but I would make it, given that you're not, you know, I guess you're not been in the entertainment business as long as I have, I would keep it tight, really. I would write it out. In your case, and I think most people, really, I would write it out, get your ideas, make sure that they're original, you know, because, you know, nobody needs to hear kind of banal ideas, you know, that everybody has. Make sure that you've got something interesting to say, find a subject maybe, but I'd say in your case, keep it tight, really.
And get yourself a great editor.
And get yourself a great editor, like Talal.
All right, we've had so many emails about Bobby Chariot, Alexei. You know, from like Paul, Stuart, Callis, Kurtz, James, Mark, thanks for reaching out. They're all interested. How is he? How are his nerves? Is he ever coming back? Do you think he'll ever be on the podcast? Anything to say about that, Alexei?
Yeah, well, Bobby, to explain for you that don't know, Bobby, I mean, I'm not a great character comedian, that really the... Yeah, the best of my work was kind of done as me, or a kind of version of me. But the best character I ever came up with was Bobby Chariot. And that, just to... when Victoria Wood had some shows in the '80s and the '90s. I can't remember when they were. And she had this linking character, which was a kind of continuity announcer who would come in from time to time and do bits in the show, played by Susie. I can't remember her second name. Anyway, and I when I was stopped doing stuff and did the all-new Alexei Sayle show, in which I had, rather than Renick and Marshall, I had two different writers, Linhan and Matthews. I wanted to have a kind of recurring character, a similar recurring character to what Vic had done in her show. And so I hit upon this idea of the warm-up man. Now, the warm-up man is a familiar, anybody who's been to a comedy recording at the BBC, you would see these warm-up men there. And there were comedians who were either on their way up or on their way down, really. And that, what happens is that when there's a break in recording, that the warm-up man comes on and does, you know, keeps the audience kind of laughing along while they move the sets around and stuff. And I'll tell you an interesting, actually, story about Bobby Chariot, that sometime in maybe the early 90s, I did a film I'd co-written called Itch, about a mysterious man who's stuck on a traffic island for a year. And it was one of the actors on the film was a child actor, and it was a young Johnny Lee Miller. And I made up this comedy character. And at the time he was called Monk Seaton's Own, just to keep Johnny Lee Miller amused. I think he was about 10 or something then. I started making up these stories about a kind of failed comedian who was called Bobby Chariot and lived at the time in Monk Seaton in County Durham for some reason. And that was the genesis of the idea. Anyway, when I, and I've never told anybody, I've never, just telling you people. So I actually invented Bobby Chariot for a young Johnny Lee Miller. And he, you know, has since gone on. He was in Trainspotting, obviously. And then he did, is it called Elemental with, which is a long running TV series in the US. And of course, Johnny Lee has rewarded me, like many people in my life, has rewarded, who I've helped out, has rewarded me by never giving me a fucking cameo performance in Elemental. Thanks a lot, Johnny Lee. I think he was married to Angelina Jolie for a bit, wasn't he? Briefly.
Beats me.
Or he went out with Angelina, young Angelina
Jolie. He didn't even send you a Christmas card?
Ah, fucking nothing.
Fucking asshole.
Yeah. Anyway, so that's who I... That was the genesis of Bobby Chariot. Anyway, when we did the all-new Alexei Sayle show, I kind of wrote this character called Bobby Chariot, and he was a failed stand-up comedian. And the makeup people did a brilliant job of doing his wig, and then the wardrobe people also did a wonderful job on his suit, that purple suit. And the teeth that we had, Eve Wignall was the makeup woman, I remember. We had a special set of teeth made for him, which I still have, although I think your teeth change as you grow older. So I still have them somewhere, but I think if I put them in now, they wouldn't really fit. So anyway, yeah, Bobby Chariot. So we had this, we would have these kind of fake breakdowns in the recording of the show, and Bobby would come on. But Graham and Arthur, Linnan and Matthews wrote some of his best material. So they wrote some brilliant lines for him. And I remember there's the record. I mean, I think it's on like YouTube, where he says, "Did he say what? This is like torture, isn't it?" And he says, it's like a few people, he says, "Has anybody here been tortured?" And one man puts his hand up and he says, "I remember it was an extra and we had real difficulty getting him to do it, get it right." But anyway, we said, man puts his hand up and he says, "Yes, I have," and then starts crying. And then Bobby says, "Oh, really? What was it like?" I know I love Bobby. I have thought over the years of bringing him back. Bobby. I do love Bobby. I think it's probably too late to bring him back, really. But he was on pills for his nerves, sleeping in his Jag. I think when we did the merry-go-round, he'd had a kind of ironic, students had taken him up, and he'd had a kind of, he was having a second life as kind of ironic sense. He might still be, he might have got himself, like, he might have got, he might have had, like, therapy or something, or become a Buddhist and have his own radio show on BBC Radio Durham, something like that, maybe. Things might not have turned out so bad for him, I don't know. How's Stan Boardman doing these days? But, yeah, no, I did love Bobby. I think it's probably too late to bring him back, really.
We'll search for him. Maybe he's in a Buddhist temple somewhere.
Yeah.
Okay, and something else we get lots of emails about, Alexei, is basically people wanting more. Why isn't the podcast out more often? Why don't you do more YouTube videos? They want more, Alexei. And I do know that this week's podcast is out a little late, so maybe it's a good opportunity to address that.
Yeah, well, I don't know. I don't know if I mentioned this, I think, in the first one, but, you know, I'm 68, for a start. I'm 68. I'm an old man. I've had my vaccination, but I'm 68. And also my model for working was that I would write something. Many fine people would work on it. It would then be broadcast on a channel, which gave it authority, you know, one of the three or four channels that there used to be, TV channels or radio channels. And then I got paid a shitload of money. So by contrast, podcasting, it seems to me, is very much, I have no authority. I'm fighting against every other fucker on the internet. It's costing me money to do this. And I'm giving my shit away for nothing. So, For me, I do it as well. It's funny. Less podcasts, but, you know, people that write stuff, I look at their websites. I got to fucking, you know, he hasn't put anything up for 3 days. What the fuck? And then I forget, I'm not paying anything for this. The guy's not, you know, the guy's doing it for free. And so why have I got any expectations? So what I'm saying is, you know, I mean, this has to work for me as well, and it's I like it. It's very much a learning exercise, but there's elements of it that are very much against my nature. So you know, I have my own radio show that gets 3-4 million listeners. Does that sound arrogant? Does that sound unacceptably arrogant, Talal?
It sounds arrogant, but not unacceptably
lovably arrogant.
Yes, charming, sounds lovely, exactly.
So it's good for me to develop ideas. It's good for me to, you know, talk about political issues, and I will boil this material down until live work is able to come back. And I like the bike rides as well. I'm very keen on them, but this is not going to be, this stuff's going to come out when it comes out. It's not. It's not going to be like other people's podcasts, but I think.
You're saying lower your expectations.
Yeah,
and be happy with what you're getting.
Fucking right.
You hear that? Okay, and finally, Alexei, we've been getting lots of emails complimenting the music on the show, and a couple saying they don't like it, but they can fuck off. But lots of compliments for the music. So just a reminder: all the music on this show is made by Tarbush Records.
Yeah.
If you look for Tarbush Records on Instagram and YouTube, they have lots of great content out there. So go and look for them. If you like the music, go and find them. They do lots of cool stuff. And they do a bit of comedy content as well.
Do they?
Yeah.
I like them. I like it personally. That's why I have it on the show.
Good to know.
And speaking of Tarbush Records, cue the outro music. You've been listening to the Alexei Sale podcast with the added sound of rain falling on my shed. The show was produced and edited by Talal Karkhouti. Music by Tarbush Records. Sound engineering by Anthony Overton. Please check out my YouTube channel. It's called Alexei Sale, and you'll find my bike rides and everything else there. If you're enjoying the show, tell your mates. That's it from me. See you again next time on the Alexei Sale podcast.